Talking History. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and work of a writer of one of the most, well, some of the most compelling and important works of the 20th century. Someone who reshaped modern literature and gave the world the term Kafkaesque. It's, of course, the one and only Franz Kafka. We'd love you to join the discussion if you can drag yourselves away from the men's final at Wimbledon, the men's tennis final. It is an epic 12-12, two sets each, and final set. It really is quite incredible. But we want you to take yourselves away from it and join our discussion tonight. Text us on 53106. Text costs 30 cents, or email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we looked at the history of the East India Company, and we debated how it became an instrument for empire, as well as the world's first modern multinational corporation. And if you'd like to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. Born in Prague, then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in 1883, Franz Kafka became a lawyer in an insurance company after leaving university and began writing short stories and novels. Diagnosed with tuberculosis, he was unable to fight in the First World War. He never married, and he died in 1924. Few of Kafka's works were published in his lifetime, and he achieved lasting fame only after his death. His works, The Metamorphosis, The Trial, and The Castle, are now considered classics, and the term Kafkaesque entered the popular lexicon. W.H. Auden called Kafka the Dante of the 20th century, and in tonight's show we want to explore his works and his remarkable contribution to literature. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our absolutely superb panel of experts. We are delighted to be joined by Professor Ruth Gross, who teaches at NC State University in North Carolina, an expert on the works of Franz Kafka and two-time past president of the Kafka Society of America. Her books include critical essays on Franz Kafka, and she's the co-editor of the Franz Kafka Encyclopedia and, with Stanley Korngold, Kafka for the 21st Century. Dr. Stanley Korngold is Emeritus Professor of German and Comparative Literature at Princeton University and has been credited with fundamentally reshaping our view of Kafka over the past 50 years, most notably with his Kafka trilogy, The Commentator's Despair, Franz Kafka, The Necessity of Form, and Lambent Traces, Franz Kafka, works which opens Kafka's depths to generations of students and general readers. Dr. Dara Downes is a teaching fellow in the Department of German at Trinity College Dublin and is an expert on the 19th century and European modernism. And we're also joined for the first part of the show by Professor David Sukoff, Professor of English at Colby College in Maine, an expert on cultural criticism, and his books include Kafka's Jewish Languages, The Hidden Openness of Tradition. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Professor Anna Fuchs, the director of the Humanities Institute of Ireland at UCD and the author of and a very influential essay on Kafka's The Trial, and Benjamin Ballant, a library fellow at the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem and the author of Kafka's Last Trial, and Professor Carolyn Duttlinger, co-director of the Oxford Kafka Research Centre and the author of The Cambridge Introduction to Franz Kafka. Well, as I say, it really is a superb, very high profile and very high level panel tonight. And Ruth, I'll begin with you, and I'll begin with maybe the big question to ask tonight. Why is Kafka such an influential and important writer, and why should people still read him today?
Well, it's a big question. It's what I always start out my own classes with, because it's funny that students today, at least our American students, we always used to be able to count on them having read some sort of Kafka in high school, and now fewer and fewer are reading Kafka in high school. So it's much more important for them to get it when they get to college. The question, why read Kafka? You explained that he was born in 1883 in Prague, which at that time was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Prague was a Czech-speaking city, but Kafka himself was a German speaker in Prague. He was a Jew in a Catholic society. He was the ultimate outsider in every way. Not only was he an outsider in his bigger macrocosm, but in his own home, he wanted to write. He was a writer in a very bourgeois merchant family. He was a bachelor, as you said, among married friends among in a society that really prized marriage and progeny. So he was an outsider, the ultimate outsider. Well, that experience of being an outsider comes through in his texts. That crazy uneasiness, that feeling of alienation, and also perhaps the feeling that he's somehow responsible for being that outsider comes through in his texts. And so when we read his texts, we who today feel somewhat like outsiders, I don't think there's anyone I talk to that doesn't feel somewhere she or he is an outsider in his own or her own society. That feeling comes through in his texts, and we read his texts and we have this feeling, oh my gosh, he knows me, he feels me. His texts are very personal. The other reason to read Kafka is because there are no easy answers. There are no finite answers in his texts. We read his texts and we come out thinking, how am I going to explain this? I have to explain my own self, in a sense, before I can explain the text. And so we read them through different lenses, sometimes religious, sometimes existential, sometimes historical, sometimes biographical, or sometimes all of these. And we get to new and varied answers and readings in these texts. So they're like puzzles. At the same time that they are sometimes horrifying, because we do identify with them and we see how horrible things can be, they are also very entertaining. And I hope to be able to talk a little bit about the entertaining part of Kafka's texts a little bit later in the program.
Excellent. And Dara, you really get a sense there of why Kafka has such a hold on readers. There is this elusive Kafka effect.
Yeah, it's a very curious thing. When we read Kafka, we know what the words mean. We can put the sentences together. We have a good idea what's going on, but we don't know what the damn thing means. It's as though somebody needs to slip us the key to what's going on. And Kafka is a genius at creating this. And to tie in with what Ruth was saying about the outsider, Kafka is a genius at turning his reader into an outsider within the texts that he himself has written. I think our own John Bandel put this best about this elusive Kafka effect when he said that in Kafka, something is always not being said. What is it? And that question, it seems to be so elusive, the answer to that question. So Kafka is not difficult to read, but he's impossible to read at the same time. And I'm actually honoured to have the great Stanley Korngold on the line as well here. Stanley, would it be very impertinent of me if I would ask you a question? You're very well known for one line in particular about Kafka as the ecstatic. How do you think that relates to Kafka's Jewishness in particular?
Thanks for asking me that question. It's not an easy one. Well, first, to his ecstatic mood on composing his first great story called The Judgment. He was up all night. He wrote it in, as he said, in the German expression, in einem Zug, in one go. If you look at the manuscript, which is held at the Bodleian in Oxford, you see there are virtually no alterations to the text in his handwriting. It came to him. It was a breakthrough. And some readers of Kafka, careful readers of Kafka, conclude that his entire life thereafter was a search for this ecstatic experience. How that connects to certain currents in Jewish thought, for example, the little-known Gnostic current is a topic for discussion. Sholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, has identified this Gnostic strain, which means what? It's the sense that everyday life is fallen, but there are gleams possible. There are moments corresponding to Kafka's ecstatic breakthrough when he wrote the judgment, I'd say, when he read it, because he loved to read it aloud and experience something of that excitement. The original excitement was confirmed, he said, as he read it aloud, he felt something of that same ecstasy. How that connects to the Gnostic strain in Judaism is a rather esoteric topic. One can point to the fact that Prague, it was alert to mystic philosophies, to theosophies, to Gnostic strains. Kafka may have imbibed some of that. He had a work on Gnosticism in his personal library, but the ecstatic breakthrough occurs a little bit off the side of his interest in Jewish mysticism.
Very interesting. And David, continuing on that, the fact that he was a Jewish writer in this period, it's very interesting to look at his relationship with language, because it was something he was very aware of.
Exactly. And I just wanted to add to what all said. Part of this ecstatic creativeness that came out of this sense of being an outsider had to do with the linguistic ferment in Prague at this time. While his family was very middle class and bourgeois, and were Jews turning away from their Jewish background, as many parents will do trying to be successful, Kafka did the opposite. He turned back to the Yiddish language that was scorned at the time, that his parents were leaving behind. And he saw creativity. He saw a mixture of many different foreign elements put together in an emerging language, and that excited him very much. That's also imprinted in that story in The Judgment. He says that the story came out of him as if he were like a real birth, and he was covered in filth and slime. Part of that creativity is he needed to jettison or re-understand the attitudes towards his own language that were, or his parents' language or his people's language that were current at the time, and he made art out of obstacles that way. So part of that linguistic ferment was in Yiddish. Later in life, he learned modern Hebrew. One of his Hebrew teachers was Pua Ben Tuvim. She was one of the first native speakers of the revived spoken Hebrew. She had come from Jerusalem. That's imprinted in his work. So in some ways, being an outsider was a thorn bush in the road, as he said in one of his aphorisms. And he said, you have to be set on fire for you to go further. So he found the obstacles that were sort of surrounding him as a Jewish writer, and by turning to these languages, he found inspiration and he found different ways of looking at his own tradition. And I think we feel those many levels when we read his work. That's part of the excitement of it.
Ruth, I'd like to ask you about the other dimensions to his work, because one aspect that's often overlooked when we think of him in terms of alienation and bureaucracy and some of these darker themes is that actually he's also a very funny writer.
Yes. The first thing you think of when you think of Kafka is not clearly humor, but there are some very, very funny moments in Kafka. His humor is one that comes from a kind of ironic distance to himself. I think it's a kind of a Jewish humor, hopeless but not serious, sometimes coming up that way. He laughs at human situations because he knows that we're all going to lose eventually, and that by standing back and looking at that, he can see the humor in that. As I said, it's both horrifying, but also can be very funny. It's perhaps a Jewish humor only darker, since we were talking about Judaism. There's a certain darkness to it as well, but it's a beautiful thing when you get there. The other thing about his humor is it's very graphic. Because he was an artist himself, I think it has to do with that. I don't know for sure, but he was an artist. He loved to make sketches, and he details things so carefully. His descriptions of everything in his stories is so clear and lucid. And if you imagine those details visually, they become very funny. Even something as horrifying as Gregor in The Metamorphosis, when he wakes up and changes into that vermin, that giant vermin, whatever it is, how it's described with the belly and all of this, you can writhe, but you can also, when you visualize it, you see something very funny about this insect trying to get up out of bed. So there's that graphicness about his humor, which is very funny. There's also something very Chaplin-esque about it. It's very visual humor. It's a funny humor. I mean, a funny way of looking at things, because I think it's harder to describe humor. You can't really describe humor. It's not funny. You can't describe a joke. I would like to read a short story by him, Poseidon. I think that really does convey the humor very, very well. And I think your readers, your listeners will enjoy hearing the story. I don't know if this is the point you want to
do. Oh, definitely. I would love to hear it.
Okay. This is called Poseidon. This is a story that was written probably in late 1920, and it was not published until well after his death. Max Brod, his good friend, found the story and published it in 1936. But it is a wonderful story about bureaucracy, and I think you will get the humor very quickly. Poseidon sat at his desk doing the accounts. Administering all the waters meant that he had an endless task. He could have had assistants, as many as he wanted, and he did have a great many. But because he took his office very seriously, he did the accounts over again, and so his assistants were of little use to him. It cannot be said that the work gave him pleasure. Really, he did it only because it was imposed on him. Indeed, he had often applied for what he called more cheerful work, but then whenever various proposals were made to him, it turned out that nothing really appealed to him so much as his present office. It was also very difficult to find something else for him to do. After all, he could not possibly be put in charge of, let us say, one particular ocean, apart from the fact that here, too, the work of doing the accounts would be not less, but only more small-minded. The great Poseidon could only be given a superior position. And if he was offered a position unrelated to the waters, the very idea made him feel sick. His divine breathing became irregular, his bronzed chest began to heave, and his complaints were not really taken seriously. When a mighty man pesters, one must try to seem to accommodate him, even when his case was absolutely no prospect of success. No one really thought of removing Poseidon from his office. He had been fated to be the god of the seas from the beginning of time, and that was how it had to be. What mostly annoyed him, and this was the main reason for his dissatisfaction with his office, was hearing about the ideas that people held of him. How, for example, he continually went dashing over the waves with his trident. Meanwhile, he was seated in the depths of the world's ocean, continually doing the accounts. An occasional trip to Jupiter was the sole interruption of the monotony. A trip, by the way, from which he usually returned in a rage. As a result, he had hardly seen the oceans, except fleetingly, during his hasty ascent to Olympus, and had never really traveled through them. He used to say that he was waiting until the end of the world. Then there might come a quiet moment when, just before the end, and after going over the final reckoning, he could still make a quick trip tour.
Absolutely superb. Okay, Ruth, thank you so much for that. We're going to take a very quick break now. You really captured the essence there. We're going to take a very quick break now. We come back, we'll be talking to Professor Anna Fuchs and exploring what it means for something to be Kafkaesque.
This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. I'm delighted to be joined now by Professor Anna Fuchs. She's Director of the Humanities Institute of Ireland at UCD, an expert on German literature in the 20th and 21st centuries and the work of Kafka. Her forthcoming book is Precarious Times, Time and Temporality in Modern German Culture. And she's recently published an article on Kafka's The Trial. Anna, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can we maybe start off by trying to assess Franz Kafka's place within the German literary canon?
Well, first of all, I would say we need to assess his place perhaps in world literature rather than German literature, because I think his work is of universal significance. Why am I saying this? Well, Kafka was a German Jew born in Prague, and that already sets him up in a very multicultural context. So he was born of Jewish parents who had assimilated. He grew up in largely a German-speaking culture in Prague, so he was what you could call a minority writer. But of course, his work is of universal significance. Why? Well, I would say his work is of universal significance because he's a deeply political writer, not party political, but political. He's interested in the mechanisms of power. That is his most pervasive theme from his early works right through to his late works, say The Castle, which is his last novel. Now, when I say he's interested in the mechanisms of power, I don't mean that he writes like a sociologist. He doesn't. He likes like one of the most finely tuned modern writers. So when I say this, I mean that he always adopts the perspective of his protagonists. So this means that when we read Kafka, we are looking at the world from the limited perspective of the modern individual who's struggling to comprehend an impenetrable reality. Now, of course, this has given us the adjective Kafkaesque. So what do we mean when we say, oh, a situation is Kafkaesque? Well, we mean we are faced with a bureaucracy that we can't penetrate, that we can't understand. Perhaps we are trying to make contact with officials who are not available. And all these experiences are the foundational experiences of Kafka's protagonists. So he is a quintessentially modern writer in that he gives us a profound analysis of what's wrong with the modern condition.
It's very interesting because many people are familiar with the term Kafkaesque without ever having read any of Kafka's writings. Do you think he's a writer who perhaps should be read more?
Perhaps people aren't reading Kafka because they are afraid, you know, by his reputation. But actually, I would say that Kafka is immensely enjoyable, and this is why people should read him. He's not unapproachable. He is difficult, but he's difficult in a good way. He's challenging us to think about what it means to inhabit the modern world. So I'll give you an example. Let's look at the opening sentence of The Metamorphosis, one of his world-famous stories that he wrote in 1912, which was a particularly productive year for Kafka. Now, I have the English translation in front of me. When Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a monstrous insect. Now, that's an astonishing opening. Why? Well, first of all, the event itself, the transformation of a human being into some kind of vermin or insect, reminds us of the fairy tale. But the tone of this passage is anything like a fairy tale, right? So Kafka uses a very striking image, an image that you find around 1912 in the works of other expressionist painters or writers. But unlike these who kind of write about big events, big emotions, with pathos, his tone is remarkably sober and rational. So there's a discrepancy between the event on the one hand and the style that he's using. And that immediately sets up a question. Well, Gregor Samsa wakes up transformed and finds himself transformed into this big beetle. Why did this happen? Now, you would assume that the protagonist who undergoes such fundamental change in his life would be worried or concerned and say, oh my God, what has happened to me? But he doesn't do that. On the contrary, he looks down his transformed body, and this is again a meticulous description of the bug's belly, of his back, of his countless little legs that Gregor can't handle. And then he begins to worry about work. He's late for work. So he thinks, oh my God, I might have missed my first train. What about, maybe if I rush now and get up now, I'll get the next train. But if I'm late, the chief clerk will turn up, and oh my God, that will have implications for my family, because then it turns out that Gregor Samsa is the breadwinner, the main breadwinner in the Samsa family, who's paying back the parents' debt. So we are immediately in a domestic scene. And Kafka then dissects the family dynamic. Families in Kafka's world are not cozy social relations. They are full of tension, especially when it comes to the relationships of fathers and sons. And anybody who's read this story will know that in the course of this novella, the father, who appears to be a kind of an elderly, tired gentleman, turns into a proud, powerful, deadly figure who actually causes the death of Gregor the bug by throwing apples at him, which are lodged in his back, and they cause a fatal injury. So in the end, Gregor dies and is discarded as rubbish.
Your passion brings the stories to life and makes us want to pick up the works of Kafka. Do you think that people misunderstand the works when they read them, or is it more that their impression of Kafka prevents them from picking them up in the first place?
So I think it's the latter interpretation, because once you pick up a book by Kafka, be it a short story or one of the novels, you're drawn into them. You're drawn into them because you look at the world from the perspective of these vulnerable characters, protagonists, who are ordinary people. They are like us. They are faced with ordinary choices. But the difference is they're always encountering systems or bureaucracies or systems of power that defeat them. Yeah. And of course, this means it makes us think about things like justice, authority, relationships. Who holds power? Why is it that Joseph K. never really encounters a judge on his journey towards, well, injustice, actually? Why is it that he was arrested, even though the first sentence of the novel tells us that he was arrested without having done anything wrong, right? Why is it that he is arrested and not charged? This is really extraordinary. We have a protagonist who is arrested on the morning of his 30th birthday, and exactly 1 year later he's executed like a dog. Nowhere in the novel are we told why he's arrested. What was the crime that he committed? Actually, there's a sense that the court attracts guilt. But what type of guilt? Is it metaphysical guilt? Is it legal guilt? And the novel bounces us between all these possibilities, ranging from kind of the modern analysis of a corrupt justice system to a metaphysical dimension. And we can't reconcile them. We don't know, is this anchored in the real? Is it a dream? And that makes Kafka infinitely interesting, because whenever you reread Kafka, you will discover something that you've missed.
So in many ways, he's a writer ahead of his time. He could be writing today. He could have been writing at the end point of the 20th century. It's hard to imagine that he was creating all of these works in the first part of the 20th century.
Yes, and I think that if Kafka lived today, he would be really interested in technology, as he was during his own time. So, for example, the telephone plays a key role in many of his works, right? So when Joseph K. is summoned for his first hearing, he's summoned by telephone, and he uses a tram to get there. He also walks part of the way. But if you look at the descriptions of Kafka's world, they are full of the latest technology in the early part of the 20th century.
Today he'd be getting a text message.
Totally. And he would be using this in his novels. I have no doubt about it. So, or for example, Kafka was interested in, he liked cars. He liked being driven around in a car. He went to Italy, where he observed the first public display by plane. He wrote a short piece about that, the aeroplane in Brescia. So he was infinitely attracted to the latest modern technologies, and he used them, he inserted them in his novels. So if he happened to live in the 21st century, I am absolutely certain that he would make the most of social media in his narratives.
Well, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. Professor Anna Fuchs, Director of the Humanities Institute of Ireland at UCD. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
I would have loved to have talked for another 20 minutes. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely wonderful. And I would have loved to have listened to you for another 20 minutes, or indeed the full show. Absolutely brilliant. We'll be back with more on Franz Kafka after this break.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Kafka. And I'm delighted to be joined on the phone now by Benjamin Ballant, who's a library fellow at the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem. And he's the author of the new book, Kafka's Last Trial, The Case of a Literary Legacy. It's published in hardback by Picador and costs $14.99 sterling, so about €17. And Benjamin, you're very welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
It's an extraordinary story that this book recounts, and in a way the story itself is Kafkaesque. Can you tell us about Kafka's last instruction to his closest friend about how he wanted all of his remaining papers to be destroyed?
In a sense, it's the most famous betrayal in literary history. As he was dying in 1924, Franz Kafka, then still largely unknown, left a couple of notes for his closest friend and mentor, Max Brod. And after the funeral, Max Brod went to collect Kafka's manuscripts and his unfinished masterpieces. And he came across these notes instructing him basically to burn all of Kafka's manuscripts unread. And there begins really this, with this ethical dilemma, begins the entire story. Because of course, Max Brod chose to do as he did, and we owe our Kafka, in a sense, to Max Brod. After this act of betrayal, I interpret it also as an act of rescue. In a sense, Max Brod rescued Kafka's legacy, not just from Kafka himself, but also he fled, Max Brod fled the Nazi occupation of Prague in 1939, and brought these manuscripts with him to Tel Aviv and devoted the rest of his life to editing and publishing the Franz Kafka that we know.
And so rescued Kafka's writing and his legacy from obscurity. Can you tell us about what happened then after Brod died himself in 1968 in Tel Aviv? Because suddenly there was this huge and hugely controversial court case over what would happen to all of these other papers that had not yet been published.
Yeah, in essence, Max Brod escaped, as I said, in 1939 from Prague with a single suitcase, and the only place that he could find refuge was in then British Mandatory Palestine, and where he lived the second half of his life, from 1939 until his death in 1968. During all those decades, he was editing and publishing Kafka, and to do so, he needed help. And for that, he turned to his closest friend and his secretary, who was another Prague emigre named Esther Hoffe. And when he's writing his will in the 1960s, Max Brod, who did not have children himself, says two things. He says, on the one hand, I give all of my estate, including this priceless Kafka material, to Mrs. Hoffe. On the other hand, I also instruct you, Mrs. Hoffe, that before you in turn pass away, that you would arrange for the proper deposit of this material in, and now I'm quoting from his will, either the National Library in Jerusalem, the Tel Aviv Municipal Library, or another archive here or abroad. Not exactly the most specific will that's been written. And so when he dies in 1968, he gives everything to Esther Hoffe, and she does something that she never dared to do during Max Brod's lifetime. She starts to sell things off piecemeal. Most famously, in 1988, she goes to Sotheby's in London and auctions off Kafka's original manuscript of his unfinished novel, The Trial. It earns the highest price ever paid for a modern manuscript to that point. And the buyer is the Marbach German Literature Archive in Germany. And that's really where the whole trial begins. When she herself dies in Tel Aviv in 2007, she wants to pass it on to her daughters. And at that point, the state of Israel steps in and says, no. This, we object to the probate of your will. This material belongs to sort of, you know, its cultural heritage of this country. It doesn't belong in private hands. And therein begins the legal complications.
And it was essentially a debate about where that legacy belonged, whether it was the country of his birth, but the one that had been responsible for the deaths of three of his sisters during the Holocaust, or whether it was the state of Israel, a state that he would have liked to have lived in but never saw.
That's exactly right. So it became very quickly a three-way trial. I was in the Supreme Court here in Jerusalem attending some of the hearings, and I was really astonished. You had on the one hand the daughter of Esther Hoffe, her name is Eva Hoffe, representing the family interest. You had the German team from Marbach, and you had the Israelis represented by the National Library here. And in this triangle of interest was this, it really opened up these incredible sort of national ideological questions that you might not expect in something that began as a Mira Wills case. So as you say, you know, this ideologically charged language really rose to the surface. And for the Israelis, they saw Kafka as somehow, although, as you say, he never stepped foot here. He died in 1924 before there was a state of Israel. He was not a Zionist like his friend Max Brod was. They still felt that somehow the end of Kafka's story, or the proper culmination of that story, is really here in Jerusalem. For the Germans, on the other hand, Kafka, because he wrote in German, is really part of the German modernist literary canon and very firmly belongs in Marbach at the German Literary Archive. So as you say, the Holocaust came up in this, but also really it wasn't just any two countries that came to a head in the trial. It was precisely Germany and Israel with the very fraught past that came to a head in the courtroom that day.
And tell us then, how did this trial end? Who won in the end?
Yeah, this is a spoiler alert time, I suppose. But in the end, the Supreme Court panel of three judges decided unanimously in favor of the National Library of Israel. And Eva Hoffe, the daughter, was forced to surrender without any compensation whatsoever this material that is really quite priceless. Of course, I interviewed her extensively. She was devastated by this verdict. She saw it as a kind of state appropriation of private property. She lamented the ways in which states such as Israel and Germany seek to kind of, you know, nationalize literature. And she found a great irony in the fact that it's not just any author that we're talking about, precisely Kafka, who refused to belong, who of course was not German. He'd never lived in Germany, although he wrote in German. He was a Prague author, but who also refused to belong to really any sort of collective, who was individualist to his core. So that was one of the great ironies of this case. I should add also, if I can just say one more thing, which is that this material was also not well preserved. Part of it was in the home of the Hoffes in Spinoza Street in Tel Aviv, which they shared with perhaps a dozen cats. And finally, about half a year after the verdict came down in the summer of 2016, the first team of experts from the National Library was permitted finally to go into that apartment. And they were appalled by what they saw. I interviewed several members of that team who described not just cats, but cockroaches, and described how some of these priceless manuscripts were stored in an unplugged refrigerator and this kind of thing. So now these materials it's really an active case. They're really, as we speak, being sorted and digitized here in Jerusalem.
Okay, well, Benjamin, congratulations on the book, Kafka's Last Trial, The Case of a Literary Legacy, published in hardback by Picador, the author Benjamin Ballant. And we'll be back with more on the legacy of Kafka right after this break.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life, work and legacy of Franz Kafka. I'm joined by Professor Ruth Gross, Dr. Stanley Korngold and Dr. Dara Downes, and we're delighted to be joined by Professor Carolyn Duttlinger, who's co-director of the Oxford Kafka Research Centre, a fellow of Wadham College at the University of Oxford and the author of the Cambridge Introduction to Franz Kafka and Kafka and Photography. And before the break there, we heard from Benjamin Ballant and Professor Anna Fuchs. Dara, before we go any further, let's talk about the kind of person Kafka was. How much do we know about his personality?
We know a great deal indeed, not just through reading of the fictions, but also the copious diaries which he kept and all the letters which he wrote. He was a man with the most intense inner life, a hypersensitive man, with a great deal of self-loathing. He found his own body repellent, and he found it a great chore to have to get up every morning and go to work and prepare a face to meet the faces that he had to meet. And that was his great curse of his existence. It was almost what Samuel Beckett would call the sin of being born. He, at times, reading his diaries and his letters, it feels as though he's not so much a life as an apology for having a life. Writing for him was the salvation. It's what Stanley Gorngold calls the ecstasy. It's that stepping outside of that quotidian everyday self. So he had the most bizarre routine. He would get up for work and go to work from 8 till about 2 or half 2, come home, lunch, dinner, eventually take a walk, and then he'd have a kind of a long siesta before dinner, and then finally, 10:30 or sometimes 11:30, he sits down at his desk in his room. He's a bachelor. He never married. He always faced that Kierkegaardian question, to marry or not to marry. In the end, he said no. And he would write into the wee hours. And those were the times of heightened consciousness, heightened awareness for him. Without that, he felt he had nothing to live for.
Very interesting. And Stanley, let's talk about that daily working routine, because it is fascinating that he was in this insurance world, and he was doing some legal work. And was there a sense that that was also playing into then the writing he was doing late at night?
Oh, yes, I think so. We owe a great debt to a scholar by the name of Benno Wagner, who published Kafka's office writings, and we've translated them and written commentaries to them and sought analogies between the texts he wrote as an in-house lawyer at an insurance institute and, of course, his fictional works. We're not going to say that he simply exported data from his daily routine as an insurance lawyer into his stories, but nonetheless, he used this material as a starting point for reflection and metamorphosis. So we get versions of the rich materials of his daily work in the stories. I mean, for example, there are very obvious parallels, carryovers, when he writes in The Penal Colony about a torture machine that lacks spare parts. Well, his insurance work involved treating respectfully returning veterans who had been wounded. He was aware of the First World War. He was responsible for workmen's compensation, where this time the workmen were soldiers who were mutilated, not in factories, but on the front lines of the war. So issues of materiel and spare parts, right, preoccupied him in the office as well as in his work. But that's a kind of one-to-one, a more nearly one-to-one analogy. The topic is very rich and open to a lot of reflection. Let me just suggest one way in which his understanding of insurance deeply influences his presentation of ideas and competing ideologies in his stories, because that's the case. The point of insurance is that a community of persons are willing to contribute to the injuries suffered not by themselves immediately, but by others in the community. They take up a slack. You get something like that in his stories, in which competing ideologies fight with one another, and it is not clear who the victor is. One person or idea loses, as for example, Joseph K. in the trial loses at the hands of that powerful court. On the other hand, in the penal colony, it's an agent of the court, as it were, an agent of the administration of the island, who is laid on a torture machine, and he is killed. Who here is the agent of injustice? Who is the culprit here? Who is responsible for all this harm? Responsibility seems to be distributed equally between culprits and agencies that punish. This can vex readers, but also fascinate readers, because it becomes very difficult to decide who's the good guy and who is not in these struggles. What about the Chinese government versus the nomads? Who's right in that struggle? So what you have here is a balancing out of responsibility, right, among several persons. And there is that analogy, then, it seems to me, with the way injuries are, the responsibility for injuries is shared by members of the insurance community. And, of course, we all want to be part of an insurance community. So this notion could be called a sort of, it has been called a sort of culture insurance. Kafka gives the responsibility and the benefit equally, or distributes responsibility for harm done among several agents who seem to be opposing one another, but in fact constitute a kind of insurance group. And we can go on and on, talk about the various concrete ways in which his fascination with insurance enters his stories. Let me just say one more concrete thing about that analogy. Can't we understand a couple of Kafka's stories about stories that deal with crimes or injuries that cannot be insured against? Isn't that the point, in a way, of Gregor Zamsa, who wakes up as a verminous beetle? Can Gregor be insured against this predicament? Well, we can't write out an insurance policy because we don't have enough data. We wouldn't know what premiums one should have to pay to be protected against this injury. And what about being arrested, as Anne was telling us, without notification of the crime or the reason for the arrest? Isn't there an insurance policy that would guard us against the costs of that predicament?
Absolutely fascinating. Sorry,
alert not only to what can be insured, but what cannot be insured.
Absolutely brilliant. I'll bring in Carolyn here, because it's interesting, Carolyn, the way you've looked at his work, his interest in photography. And I'm sure Kafka would have been fascinated by the film adaptations that have been made of his works. I suppose most famously when Orson Welles directed a version of The Trial.
That's right. So, I mean, Kafka loved going to the cinema, and I often think when I go to the cinema myself how Kafka would have been absolutely fascinated by the technological possibilities of cinema nowadays, which, of course, are infinitely vaster than in his day. And I'm sure he would have loved the adaptation by Orson Welles, which is actually quite a bold adaptation because it takes The Trial, which is a story set in the 1910s, into the age of the Cold War. It's a sort of film noir, so it's got men in trench coats, it's got post-war architecture, there's a giant computer, there are references to the nuclear bomb, and very interestingly, there's also a brief reference to Auschwitz and to the concentration camps in a scene where you've got prisoners walking around carrying number cards around their necks. I mean, I think when it comes to Kafka adapted to film, the question is always going to be how close to the text should the director stick? What sort of degree of creative license should the director apply? To what extent should these be adaptations that are sort of historically faithful? And I think if you look at all the different adaptations that we have, there's a whole range of different responses to this question.
Very interesting. And when you talk about some of the themes that are there, power and alienation and various abuses, it's interesting mm-hmm. that there is that relevance today, that these are themes that every time you open up the newspaper in the morning or turn on the radio, are there confronting you straight away.
Absolutely. And of course, this is precisely the opening of the novel, The Trial. It starts off by saying that someone must have said bad things about Joseph K. Someone must have slandered him. So it starts off with someone telling some sort of rumor. And that's what gets the whole thing going. And so, of course, nowadays, with even just news stories, we've had this week. I think it certainly resonates, this sense of anonymity and a sort of an anonymous threat, an anonymous community that is sharing information about the protagonist that the protagonist himself just cannot penetrate.
Very interesting. Ruth, I'd love to get your recommendation for our listeners about if they wanted, if inspired by tonight's show, they wanted to go and read a work by Kafka, what one should they pick up?
Oh, one work. Obviously, most people would say Metamorphosis. I mean, that is the where I think where you start with Kafka if you don't want a long novel. The three novels that he wrote are all unfinished. So starting with something that is finished, I think, may be less frustrating. But I am a person who loves the 1 and 2 page little pieces by Kafka. I find Kafka is most Kafka in his short texts. I love reading his short texts. I would suggest you read them in Stanley's translation, because they are just marvelous, and he has a compilation of them. And I think it gives you a very great variety of what Kafka can be.
And Ruth, when you try and assess the legacy of Kafka, it's clear that he was hugely influential in terms of literature in the 20th century and in terms of even how he confronted and anticipated some of the great crises that we would face in the century. Is that his legacy, or what would you see as his great contribution?
Well, we come back to the word Kafkaesque, which has come up several times in this broadcast, and it's very interesting to me that each of our panelists might define Kafkaesque slightly differently, depending on how you see Kafka and what works you're taking. Yes, the bureaucracy and all of that, that's the bigger thing, but I think it's simply with Kafka, it is this feeling of my daily life and what is happening is something I just don't understand. The insurance that cannot be insured against, what Stanley was talking about, that is how we feel today. We can't be sure of our everyday. And I think reading Kafka helps us at least feel that we're part of a group.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Ruth Gross, Stanley Korngold, Dara Downs, Anna Fuchs, Benjamin Ballant, David Sukoff, and Carolyn Duttlinger. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Calf, my producer, and Jojo on sound. Next week, we'll be investigating the conspiracy theories surrounding the death of Adolf Hitler and looking at, well, the story of how the Panama Canal was built and the destruction that it entailed. And we'll have lots more besides in our monthly book show. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.